Light Years, an investigation into the extraterrestrial experiences of Edward Meyer, Norwegian translation link by Gary Kinder. In 1975, a Swiss caretaker named Edward Billy Meyer disappeared on his motorbike into a forest near his village. He returned with several clear photographs of a large, silvery disc hovering in the sky. Over the next 5 years, Meyer produced hundreds of bright, detailed photographs. He also recorded the sounds of beam ships, collected several metal samples, and made films of the ship in flight. Dozens of witnesses have seen the beam ships and corroborated Meyer's fantastic story. His evidence, investigated by a professional security team headed by a retired U.S. Air Force colonel, has been examined by scientists at IBM, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Arizona State University, and the M.C. Don Douglas Aeronautics Company. For the past 3 years, Gary Kinder, author of The Highly Acclaimed Victim, The Other Side of Murder, has investigated the Meyer story. Here, in a thoroughly compelling narrative, Kinder presents all sides of this controversial case, the most remarkable, well-documented UFO story in history. Part 1, Edward Meyer. Late on a cold and rainy November night in 1976, a Volkswagen and a small German-built Ford wound through the islands of darkened forest in the hills southeast of Zurich. The rain fell so hard for so long that the back roads had turned to mud and the rain dripped from the needles of tall evergreens soaking the forest floor until it was spongy. Then, the temperature cooled and large wet flakes of snow now mixed with the rain as the Volkswagen, followed by the Ford, slithered through the mud past the shadowy presence of an old farmhouse and headed further into the darkness. Wearing a grey leather jacket, a man with his left arm severed just above the elbow rode in the passenger seat of the lead car, though the driver could see nothing save the wet path before him pelted by silver rain. The man with one arm seemed able to see past the veil of darkness, to know where he was and where he was going. Above the muffled beating of the rain, he directed the driver through the darkness across a swampy meadow, down a prominent rise, to the edge of another forest, where he told the driver to stop. The car engine died quickly, and only the rain splashing on the metal roof now broke the silence. Then the headlights of both cars dimmed and went out, and the driver could see nothing in the blackness. Neither he nor a passenger in the back seat had seen anything since the headlights swept past the ghostly farmhouse a few miles back. The man with one arm instructed the driver that they were to wait for him there, that he would return in perhaps an hour, perhaps longer, he could never be sure. Then with no further word he opened the door and they watched his silhouette disappear quickly through the rain into the dark of the forest. For over a year the driver had accompanied the one-armed man to such sights, a half hour, sometimes an hour, from the village. As months passed, the journeys had taken place later at night and the sights had become increasingly remote. For someone alone, waiting in the darkness, they could be frightening. This night the presence of the other people, the man in the back seat, the man and woman in the Ford, eased the fear as he waited. Outside, the rain and wet snow continued to fall, and the driver realized they would have to mount chains on the rear tires or they would never be able to drive through the deepening mud up the rise and back several miles to the main road. If they bogged down in the mud, they would have to spend the night in the two cars. The men got out of the cars, and illuminated by the headlights, they stood in the rain and mud jacking up first the Volkswagen then the Ford. The rear tires of each car had to be raised, one at a time, then lowered, and the jack stand repositioned again in the mud and pumped again until the next tire rose inches from the ground. The chains were heavy and difficult to manipulate, especially with fingers wet and numb from the cold. The woman sat in one car then the other, dozing as the men worked. Before each chain was in place, nearly an hour had passed, and the three men were now soaked to their skins and chilled by the icy rain running in rivulets down their faces. Finally they were satisfied with the tautness of the chains, and as they began stamping about, trying to get warm, they suddenly heard a strange sound above the trees. A singing noise, recalled one of the men. They peered upward into the rain. Except for the constant flow of water dripping from the pine needles, the trees stood motionless, but still the noise was that of strong wind. The eerie sound, a high-pitched warble that pierced the falling rain, moved slowly over their heads. They followed its course with their eyes, straining to see, then suddenly the noise began to subside, and the one-armed man stood with them in the light not 2 feet away. "We didn't see him or hear him walk," remembered another. Just all of a sudden he was there. The noise in the trees had awakened the woman, who got out of the car to see the three men in their darkened and soggy clothes huddled together in the beam of the headlights and looking up into the trees. She closed the door and took one step into the mud, glancing down for only a moment. When she raised her eyes again quickly, what she saw startled her. The man with one arm was suddenly standing in the headlight beam only a few feet away, with his back to her. "In the time I looked down and up again, a split second," she remembered, "he practically grew out of the ground in front of me." The man with one arm appeared almost like an apparition in their midst. They stared at him through the rain and saw that his hair was dry. They reached for his hand, and his skin was warm to their touch. As he stood in the bright light saying nothing, they could see the rain and wet flakes of snow just beginning to form dark speckles on the bone-dry leather of his coat. One history first mentions the village of Hinwil, Switzerland in a document dated 745. 30 miles southeast of Zurich, it nestles in a landscape of rolling green hills pocketed by large islands of forest 100 feet tall, with the Alps rising in the distance. Hinwil itself, perhaps, would disappoint the tourist looking for the charm of Alpine architecture, though chalk-white chalets shuttered in green rise from the village gore and scatter among the hills. Many stark buildings constructed of concrete have risen in their midst. They resemble not so much the quaint cottages in travel brochures as they do utilitarian apartment buildings erected in the 1950s and 60s in the United States. But a short distance from the village center, along the street where Haldenstrasse, stands a three-story farmhouse built 100 years ago. During the mid-1970s, summer's grapevines climbed the sunny south wall of the old house. Flowers filled a stone water trough to the north near the entrance, and small birds fluttered in an aviary built of wood and wire. To the south and east of the house lay a small green field, and to the north and west stood more of the cold, institutional apartment buildings. The community of Hinwil had acquired the old farm years before and built the surrounding apartments to house senior citizens. Though the farmhouse someday soon would be torn down to make room for more apartments, the community now rented the house for a nominal sum to an unemployed night watchman, Eduard Mier. Mier lived in the house with his Greek wife, Calliope, nicknamed Popeye, and three small children: a girl, Nina, a boy, Atlantis, and the baby, Bashko. They had been living in the house since December 1973, though they had lived elsewhere in Hinwil for 2 years. Mier, a man of 37, had a sixth grade education. He was not a very big man, maybe 5 feet, 7 inches tall, but he was thick-chested and strong. His face was handsome, set off by unusual greenish hazel eyes. According to village records, Mier's professions were bird breeder, iron layer, night watchman. He held a permit to carry a gun because he had once worked as night security in a factory. In a former house, a tiny three-room row house contiguous to the Hinwil Village Museum, Mier had kept a cage out back filled with nearly 200 birds. He had been employed then as a night guard and, consequently, was often at home during the day. But many people in the neighborhood avoided talking to Mier because he was different. He spoke a great deal about Moses and said things other people did not understand. Julius and Erica Kagi knew the Mies better than other neighbors did because they had a daughter the same age as Nina and the two girls often played together. "He had a terrific fantasy," remembered Erica Kagi, "and I could not agree with his philosophy. But he was not a bad person. He was not even odd, he just had his own ideas and believed whatever he said." Said another neighbor, "Mier lives the way he wants to and does not adapt to anyone else's way of living." Mier had only one arm. His left arm had been severed just above the elbow in a bus accident in 1965, as he traveled from India, through Turkey, and back to Switzerland. Still, when part of the barn adjacent to the small house collapsed, Julius Kagi saw Mia rebuild the wall alone by holding the boards in place with his shoulder stump while he positioned and pounded nails with his one hand. He was faster with one hand than other people with two, recalled Kagi. Again out of a job, Mia now supported his family on the 700 francs provided him every month by the government for the loss of his arm. To supplement their income, the mice kept chickens in the attic of the old farmhouse, and Popeye sold eggs to the neighbors. To neighbors living in the apartment buildings overlooking the front door of the farmhouse, Mia seemed to be always home. In a culture that values hard work and conformity, the neighbors saw him as a singular and idle man, often lost in thought, as through the weight of the world rested upon his shoulders, and they began to talk. Then, on the afternoon of January 28, 1975, a cold day but warmer than most at that time of the year, Edouard Mia left the farmhouse on his moped, towing a tiny wagon behind him. He wound through the streets of Hinwil, steering with one hand, the empty left sleeve of his leather jacket jerking in the wind. Working his way out of town, he eventually came to a country road, which he followed for a time, then disappeared into the forest of a nature conservancy. A few hours later, he returned to the farmhouse without telling anyone where he had been. Several days passed, during which the neighbors saw Mia dawdling around the house, seemingly as always without purpose. Then, one afternoon, he again pulled his moped from a storage room, pedaled it down the driveway until the tiny motor kicked over, and rode through the village out into the country. Soon, he was lost from view in another of the islands of forest surrounding Hinwil. When he returned, as before, he told no one where he had been or why he had been there. But the Swiss are observant and curious people, and the neighbors noted his peculiar comings and goings. Within weeks, Mia was traveling regularly into the forest, guiding his moped with one hand, the tiny wagon behind. Each trip seemed to take him along a new path in a new direction through town and out into the country highways, often for as long as an hour. Later, many of his trips took him into the hills. Sometimes, he would disappear in the early afternoon and not be seen again before supper. Other times, he would sneak from the house at 1 or 2 in the morning and not return till dawn. He had to go away again and again, Popeye remembered. He would come home for 5 minutes, fix himself a cup of coffee, and hop, he was gone again. It was bad at night. You'd be sleeping peacefully and the kids were quiet in bed. All of a sudden, he would get up, get dressed, and be gone. You know? You think your husband is lying in bed next to you, but he is gone. I did not know anything. All he said was that he was going to work. As the weeks passed, Mia's journeys through town and into the forests began to occur 3, 4, even 5 times a week. And his frequent departures rubbed against the grain of order and routine so conscientiously observed by his neighbors. The more he disappeared, the more they talked. The people in the neighborhood didn't know anything about what was going on, said Popeye, but they were very curious. They could tell me, to the minute, when he left on his moped and when he came back. It was always the same questions. Why did he come home so late? Sometimes he got up in the middle of the night and left, so they would hear the moped. And when he did this, it was even worse with the people the next day. Why did he leave last night? Where did he go? I would say nothing. I wasn't interested. They are just schnurriweiber, gossips. On clear nights, neighbors living in the apartment building just above the farmhouse saw Mia standing in the alleyway to the west and watching the sky through binoculars for hours. On nights when he did not leave the house, neighbors to the east saw a light burning on the second floor late into the night. A week, a month, maybe 2 months passed, Popeye could not remember. Then, one afternoon, as the two of them stood in the small living room on the second floor of the house, her husband handed her photographs. What do you think of this? He asked. But Popeye only stared at the pictures. I was shocked, she recalled, because I saw something completely new, and I did not want to believe that this existed. He said nothing at all. Didn't explain. Not one word. Her husband merely picked up the pictures and left the room, as Pope I yelled at him for wasting his time taking pictures when money for the family was so scarce. Mia next took the photographs to his friend Jacob Usperchindia, whom he had met while working at the Piatti gravel pit years earlier. Though Jacob Us was 12 years younger than Mia, the two men had struck up a lasting friendship. They spent much time together, talking about Mia's experiences during the 12 years he had travelled back and forth through India and the Middle East. But Jacob Us, too, seemed confused by the photographs Mia showed to him. He even laughed, but he promised to help his friend in any way he could. With a loan from Jacob Us, Mia placed a small classified ad in the German publication Etcetera. The ad solicited people interested in forming a group to discuss natural life, logic, and truth things metaphysical. Several more months passed. Through the summer and fall of 1975, the neighbors along Wihaldenstrasse watched Mia continue his frequent trips into the foothills and forests at all times of the day and night. On his little green moped, he often was seen at the edge of the open road, putting along 20, maybe 25 miles an hour, passed constantly by the much larger and faster automobiles. But then, something new entered Mia's routine. One Saturday afternoon, a half dozen cars appeared at the farmhouse and remained till late at night. The neighbors did not understand why people came to see this man. He was poor and handicapped, with an unkempt wife who spoke little of their language. He did not work, and his habits seemed strange. But over the weeks and months, not only did the visitors continue to come, but their numbers increased. In the tiny parlor on the second story, the man with the single arm and unusual hazel eyes spoke to these people for hours. When they left, the neighbors heard Popeye screaming at him. For many months, the neighbors watched Mia disappear frequently at odd hours and saw the cars on Saturday afternoons filling the narrow alleyway, running alongside number 10 Wihaldenstrasse, and spilling onto the streets of Hinwe. To Els von Jacobi, a journalist living in Munich who wrote frequently about metaphysics and the paranormal, had read about Eduard Mia in a newsletter printed and circulated by a self-study group in Munich in the summer of 1975. Interested, she contacted the young man who edited the newsletter and, through him, began to monitor developments in the Mia story as reported by witnesses. A few months later, after seeing photographs Mia had taken, she decided to interview him for publication. When von Jacobi arrived in Hinwe in December 1975, she found herself one of about 18 people who had come to the Mia home to listen to the man speak. She stayed for 2 days. I was impressed, she recalled. I was convinced that he had had the experiences he talked about. The facts he gave me, the pictures, the personal impression he created, there was nothing wrong. I wanted to make him known and to put his story in the papers because it was real. But something made him mad, and he told me I should not publish anything about him, so I left. But it was for his own good that he became known. Von Jacobi took her article to Quick magazine, one of the 2 largest slicks published weekly in Germany, with circulation in Switzerland and Austria as well. Hesitant to run such a story without verification, the magazine editors assigned a staff member to him to interview Mia. When the writer returned with substantially the same information von Jacobi had given to them, the editors set the article for publication on July 8, 1976. The magazine circulated rapidly through the town of Hinwe, carrying a story that astonished Mia's neighbors. For nearly a year and a half, they had observed and disapproved of his constant comings and goings at all hours of the day and night, but not one had confronted Mia about his purpose or attended one of the meetings at his home. The reason he now gave for his behavior made them angry and made them laugh all at once. Mia claimed that he had been telepathically contacted by alien beings from a planet in a star cluster known as the Pleiades. Through telepathy, said the article, the Pleiadians frequently had directed Mia to remote locations near Hinwe, where they landed a 7-meter silvery beam ship, disembarked, and met with him face to face. Most of Mia's contacts were with a female named Semjase for the Pleiadians, according to Mia. had found that females seemed to be far less intimidating to Earth humans. Mia met with her often, and she allowed him to photograph her beamship as it approached for landing and again, as it ascended. Many people laughed. But others seemed awed by the clear, color daylight photographs of the beamships and captivated by the thought of space beings alighting on Earth in a gentle and peaceful fashion. The July article in Quick led to a series of articles in various European magazines that appeared throughout the summer and fall of 1976. Il Giornale di Mystery, in Italy, published von Jacobi's original piece on Mia in August. Then, in September, the largest tabloid in Switzerland, Blick, ran the front page title Search of Verbluft Erik von Däniken, Zurich Man Amazed Erik von Däniken. More articles followed in the German magazines Echo der Frau, in October and Neue Welt, in November. One of Mia's neighbors had a son living in South Africa who even read of Mia in a newspaper there. The neighbors scoffed at the articles, certain that Mia somehow had perpetrated a hoax with his strange and seemingly purposeless perambulations about the countryside. But for those who visited the Hill House to investigate the claims further, Mia presented evidence that looked convincing. He showed scores of bright color photographs of Sam Jay's ship hovering just above a jagged line of evergreens or edged into the branches of a giant leafless birch. In his journal, he had recorded each of his meetings with the Pleiadians, detailed conversations, some 30 minutes, some longer than an hour. The journal now consumed several hundred pages and continued to grow rapidly. One afternoon, at their request, Mia took a small group into a meadow completely surrounded by tall evergreens. He told them that several nights earlier, he had met with the Pleiadians in the same meadow and that he and Sam Jay's had sat in the grass by the trees and talked for an hour. The people imagined the scene, a glowing, almost weightless craft suddenly descending upon the meadow, the luminescence from its shell pulsating against the wall of darkened trees, then, the alighting of a lithesome and human-like creature, gentle in approach, and filled with wisdom. And there, on the ground where the people now stood with Mia in the daylight, they saw three large circles, each equidistant to the others, peculiar, flattened swirls 6 feet across, perfectly symmetrical, perfectly rendered in the tall grass. Those who heard Mia speak on Saturday afternoons in his home and who read parts of his journal found the writings beautifully conceived, far more complex and sophisticated than a man of Mia's station would be capable of imagining. Sam Jay's, said Mia, had told him of life elsewhere in the galaxy, the history of her people, and that of the Earth. She had taught him to understand Earth humankind's place in the galaxy. Order exists in the universe, she said. More advanced civilizations teach the less advanced, and spiritual evolution must parallel technological progress. We, too, are still far removed from perfection and have to evolve constantly, she explained to Mia. When we choose to come in contact with an Earth human, we do so because we feel an obligation to the developing universe and to life which is already existing throughout the universe. We are not missionaries or teachers, but we endeavor to keep order throughout all areas of space. Now and then, we begin contacts with inhabitants of different worlds by searching out individuals whom we feel can accept our existence. We then impart information to those contacts, but only when their race has developed and begins to think. Then, slowly, we and others prepare them for the truth that they are not the only thinking beings in the universe. Bimir claimed that he continued to meet with the Pleiadians in the forests of eastern Switzerland and that the telepathic signals warning him of an impending contact could come at any time of the day or night. It happens like a shot, he explained. Like a cool wind going across your forehead, very, very weak, though. Following that came vibrations inside his head that produced symbols. On the one hand, it is like pictures which appear, and on the other hand, it is like a voice. There are no words for it. It is as if you heard a voice in the symbols. Mia could be in a room full of people when, suddenly, his eyes would close, his skin would grow pale, and he would begin to perspire faintly. He would then go to his room and dress in boots and a jacket if the air was cool, or a grey leather coat if the weather turned bitter. Popeye had made him a warm hat like those worn in the mountains of the Middle East, and she would fix him coffee, but if the coffee was not ready in 5 minutes, he would leave without it. He could be gone a half hour or half a day. One afternoon, Mia told his wife that he was about to have a contact and that she and the children were to come with him. Also allowed would be to others who happened to be at the house, one of whom was Hans Schutzbach, a man in his late 20s. Skeptical of Mia from the beginning and watching him closely, Schutzbach had studied every photograph Mia had taken of the beamships and had helped him to catalogue the photos. He also had driven Mia on many of his night contacts. Although a few witnesses, including Schutzbach, had seen strange lights at night that could have been beamships, no one except Mia had seen one in daylight. "I put everybody in my car as usual," recalled Schutzbach, and Billy went ahead on his moped, empty-handed. "He told us to just follow him, and he went every which way. Outside Hinl, we finally came to a little hill filled with trees. It was very exciting. Mia told them, 'All of you wait here.' Then he drove off. I don't remember how long we were standing there," said Popeye, "when all of a sudden, Atlantis jumped up and screamed, 'Look, Mommy, over there.' We all got up and there was the ship about 1,000 meters away. It was big and circular. We wanted to see more, but the ship soon disappeared. When the child screamed, Schutzbach jumped up and saw something rising out of the forest into the air. I presume it might have been a balloon," he said later, "but I have no proof of that. He tried to take a picture, but he was so nervous that at first he forgot, and then, he shook so badly he jerked the camera. That's why the picture is not sharp," he explained. "All you see is a little dot." The neighbors were certain Mia was crazy. No one took him seriously, one of them said later. The mayor of a nearby village said that Mia's stories were pure fantasy because he, the mayor, had never seen a UFO in the vicinity. People in Hinl laughed at the mention of Mia. "He is a spinner," they would say, "one who is nuts." Or they called him Verrückt, a lunatic. "Are we blind?" asked one couple, "or are we stupid because we don't see these things and he does?" Now when they watched him searching the night sky with binoculars, the neighbors would snicker and say, "He is looking for his lady from the galaxies." But the articles that, by now, had appeared in several European countries attracted dozens of curious people from all over the continent. They came to talk to Mia about the messages from the Pleiadians. To the surprise of the neighbors, these people appeared to be well-to-do, most of them driving Mercedes, many all the way from northern Germany. The neighbors could not understand how such people could be so taken in. "For us and everybody else in the neighborhood," said Franz Hansler, who lived in an apartment overlooking the farmhouse, "it was a very questionable situation. We all thought he was a fantasist. The whole house was a strange affair." Marie Hansler often spoke to Popeye, the only neighbor who did. She bought eggs from Popeye and considered her a very, very nice lady. But, she added, "I wanted nothing to do with her husband." Often Popeye came to her crying, and Hansler would teach her to sew and knit. "She was not a woman to be envied," said Hansler. "She suffered." Mia himself did nothing directly to offend the neighbors. But his teachings, his telling of fantastic stories that they felt were untrue, would aggravate them. And sometimes, so many cars trailed from the Mia driveway into the street that they blocked traffic. One of the town administrators, Rudolf Rueig, thought that all of Mia's stories were imagined, invented. "I think he invented it all." Rueig received many calls from neighbors near number 10 Wahrhaldenstrasse, most of them complaints about the presence of so many cars. Once, a worried mother called town officials because her daughter had gone to the Mia home. In the beginning, Popeye tried to talk to some of the neighbors. "But I noticed they didn't believe me," she said, "and I started to ignore them. At that time, I had my own problems." One Saturday morning, as she walked in the village with her two sons, she saw two elderly women in front of the town hall. "I didn't know them," she said later. "The children knew them, I think, from kindergarten. So they started to play with the children. Then they asked, 'What's your name?'" Basko could not yet say his name, so he always said Baskel. Then they asked, "And your last name?" "Mia." One of the women made a long face, and the other one asked me if I was the wife of that Mia. And I said, "Yes."